I had a friend, have a friend, who was a mathematician studying math in college. Mathematics is not anything I've ever understood in the way true mathematicians do. I managed to make grades in school, but I never really got what math was all about. And I've always thought, and I thought it was just peripheral. My friend enlightened me to a great extent, helping me to understand what he perceived to be the mystical nature of mathematics by providing a very interesting concept that has been important to me in many ways ever since. He said what he learned from mathematics is that if a mathematical answer is not harmonious and beautiful, then it can't be the right answer. Because all the elements, when he does the math, you know, it always comes together in some way where all the pieces fit. You can't just take fragments and just leave them somewhere else. All the numbers all work in harmony, and you end up with these results that always have a completeness to them. And he said he was an agnostic until he became a mathematician. And being a mathematician turned him into a believer, because he began to realize that the same that was true for math, which is that harmonious and beautiful was essential to truth, had to be so when he looked at areas of life which were harder to quantify. Mathematics are just symbols for deeper realities, and then we look at human beings and the messiness of karma and all that we see around us, and it's easy to decide that the answer is neither harmonious nor beautiful, but yes, it's the truth. Because this is what our senses may tell us, that life is apparently random, especially if you only think of life from the beginning of one incarnation to the end of that incarnation. It quite clearly, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's quite unfair, and it's just very easy to argue. I had a most unpleasant experience a number of years ago when I was persuaded, against my better judgment, to become part of a panel of people that was part of a program with that man. I started to call him a gentleman, but I'm not going to call him a gentleman. I'm just going to call him a man who filed the lawsuit to try to get In God We, One Nation Under God, taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance. It was done in California, and he was an attorney himself, so he could pursue the whole lawsuit without having to pay anything for it. And he was quite a celebrity among a society I didn't know existed, which is the California Association of Atheists, which is, you know, everybody bands together, birds of a feather come together. And so they decided, this man, who was a huge celebrity, whose name I've blissfully forgotten and will do my best to forget, he was a celebrity, and he was going to come and speak. And then they wanted to have, I don't know why, different points of view represented on this little panel, and then we would all discuss something or another. The details I have blotted out. But they managed to get me, and I kept saying no, and this woman kept calling me back. And she seemed such a nice person, I couldn't believe she was as committed to the point of view she was, and sort of for her sake I did it. Which they had me, they had an Episcopalian man who fit Swami's concept of we should be open-minded, but not so open-minded that our brains fall out. Well, he had crossed the line. This man, me, I said me already, and then a fundamentalist Christian who had a church across the bay, and then the president of the California Atheist Society. And the four of us spoke, plus this celebrity fellow who, you know, everybody was wowed by. Why am I telling you all of this? Oh, yeah, none of these people were stupid. The man, in fact, doing the lawsuit was really too smart, quite smart. But all of them were working, except for the fundamentalist Christian and myself. It was an odd alliance. When that program came on and I began to see what was really going to happen, a number of friends here said, well, maybe we should go with you. And I said, I don't think anybody wants to be in the room. Just let me just go by myself and David, and I'm glad no one else was exposed to it. To begin with, the man who was the president of the California Atheist Society, he was like from central casting. It was like somebody said, let's get somebody to be president of the Atheist Society, and then a bunch of B-grade actors came in, and this guy was selected. He was kind of hunched over like this, and he had long hair, very unattractive hair, that he had dyed a dark black. I'm not kidding, a dark black. And he kind of moved like this. You know, it was like, when I met him, it was first, there's one of those things where sometimes you have an inclination to laugh. You know, it's just like, are you really serious? But it was him, so I had to say, I didn't say I was pleased to meet you. I mean, I wasn't pleased to meet him. I was horrified to meet him, but there he was. And then these people started talking. The atheist had his point of view. The Episcopalian just ranted on about how everything in the universe is possible and why should we ever, for any reason, take a position on any issue, because after all, we might offend someone. And he was just really from the moon. And then there was the fundamentalist guy and me. And it was what was the most interesting thing about the whole experience was that this powerful alliance formed almost instantly between the Christian and myself. And it was like we were sitting next to each other and we were both absolutely horrified by what was going on in the room. And we were also aware of the fact that we seemed to be, I mean, with the exception of David and maybe a few others in the audience, but I don't think there were many others in the audience, we seemed to be the only two people who could tell what was going on in the room. And because of that, all theology between us, in fact, later I said, you know, in other circumstances, we would have been in opposition to each other. But in the face of the true enemy, you know, it just didn't make any difference to us. We were huddled together, literally kind of whispering from time to time. We weren't quite holding hands, but psychically we were holding hands, you know, like little orphans in the middle of this place where all these people with enormous intelligence, especially this guy who had filed the lawsuit, he was really smart. He had not only a lawyer's degree, he was a medical doctor and something else too. I mean, you know, just a great big brain that he was using, as Sri Yukteswar said, to cut off his own head, with just this sort of destruction of any possibility of any underlying beauty and purpose to life, and mocking it and then savaging it with clever words. You know, I can do a lot of words myself, so it doesn't impress me when somebody can just spin them. Some people are impressed merely by words per minute, you know, which is a contest I usually win. Sometimes among our ministers, we have a word per minute contest, and I almost always win, you know. But that's not that my brain keeps up with my mouth, but I can keep the words out. So this man, I wasn't cowed by just the sheer intellectuality of him. You could hear and feel what he was doing, which he was absolutely shooting in the dark. He was just gathering up words and clever ideas and speaking this one and throwing that one out. And the whole energy of it was, look at me. You know, aren't I intelligent? Aren't I clever? Aren't I smart for taking on this whole thing like that? But there wasn't an ounce of harmony or beauty in what he was saying. And it profoundly and deeply violated both my soul and the soul of this other man. Not because there wasn't any logic to what he was saying, or you could logic it out, but there was no intuition. There was no perception beyond the obvious. Sri Yukteswar said very simply, he said, intelligence is a two-edged sword. He said, you can use it either to cut through the veil of delusion, or it can be used to cut off your own head. He said, intelligence only becomes your ally when you accept the inescapability of spiritual law. In other words, when you perceive that the self-declared realities of the human mind do not have the power to make the world a certain way, that there is a pre-existing consciousness, that there's a pre-existing reality to this world into which we must fit. And no matter how smart and insistent you are, you'll never be the actual creator of this world. This world runs by its own divine laws. And all real understanding begins from some level beyond the intelligent mind, the superconscious self, which steps a little bit outside of, either in a flash or through persistent effort for a lifetime, and just knows that something is true. And you see, this is what Sri Yukteswar is saying. Once you have any intuitive insight, then the intelligence can be used to help you understand and flesh out that insight. But without that intuitive direct perception, the human mind can go in any direction and persuade you of anything at all. I was thinking in this context of Edison, who discovered the filament that created the first electric light. Edison started with an intuitive conviction that the light was possible and that there was a filament that would work. He didn't sort of reason out, there must be, there might be. He just knew. How did he know? Because it was a fact of the universe that his superconscious self was elevated enough to receive. Because he was dedicated, because he was disciplined, because he was impartial. He wasn't committed already to a certain point of view, and therefore only certain kinds of guidance could come in. He was willing to know, he wanted to know the truth, and therefore that put him on the level, the vibrational level, in which the angels, the masters, could give him that absolute conviction that this was possible. So then he used his intelligence to begin to seek in the material world the manifestation of what he already knew to be true. So even though he literally had to test thousands, he had to do thousands of experiments, and his coworkers were telling him, oh, please, let's give up. But he refused to give up because he simply knew it was true. And then, of course, he discovered it and everything else followed. Everything great that's done in the world is done that way. Albert Einstein, of course, perceived the reality of the universe. And then he said he spent 10 years working out the mathematics so that then he could present all the theories for which he has redirected the course of our civilization, has become immortalized as a scientist and as a great human being. But he saw it first. And then he came backwards. He didn't reason it out because intelligence just rearranges the pieces. It takes what is and then rearranges it. When you read the books, when you read true scripture, well, Swami Kriyananda's books, Autobiography of a Yogi, the Christian Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, I'll speak first of Swami's books because it's such an interesting experience to me because I've been teaching those books now for a number of years. And so I have to study them differently than you do when you just read them. If you just read them, you sort of get the drift of it and you kind of know what it is. But when I've taken the responsibility of transmitting what's in those books to others, it's like a different channel of understanding opens up. And it's so interesting to me because I'll pick up those books, or any of Swamiji's books, but most especially Revelations, the teachings of Christ, the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Well, really, I can just keep naming lots of them. But I sit with it, and I'm reading words, but all of a sudden what begins to happen to me is I feel a transmission of consciousness. And so that it's not just these interesting ideas, and I love interesting ideas. I love well-written things, and I love the play of words. So it's very easy for me to sort of dance out into those realities. And I've been listening on tape to a book by Thomas Wolfe, the book about the space program. I had to drive back and forth to Ananda Village a whole bunch of times in the month of June, which is almost a four-hour ride, so books on tapes were the only answer. And late one night, I went to the library and just got what I could. Now, I have mixed feelings about that book because the man is kind of cynical and just a tiny bit, I want to use the word dirty-minded. You know, his consciousness is a little bit low, but my, is he a clever writer. So I keep wanting to turn the book off because I don't like his vibration, but I just can't help but just admire the way he puts words together. He's so clever. But it's just cleverness. It's not wisdom. And in fact, he sacrifices wisdom for the sake of cleverness, which is why I feel morally conflicted listening to it. But you read Swami's books, and what you see there, first of all, is an absolute dedication simply to what is. But more than that, you realize that what Swamiji is doing is he's putting words on the intuition that he already had. He's not creating the truth with the words. The truth was there, and then he's putting words on it. This is what happens when you read the Holy Bible. That's why people can just read the Bible over and over. That's why Benito Cellini, when he was imprisoned in this horrible cell and all he had was the Bible and enough light 1 hour a day to read it, it still put him in bliss to be there. Because he would open the book and you would think, well, gosh, wouldn't you get bored reading the same book over and over for all those months? No. Because it's a testament, it's a revealed truth. And even though a human being wrote it down, the human being perceived a reality and knew the truth of Christ's life. He knew who Christ was, and whatever words he wrote were an expression of that. Autobiography of a Yogi. Master said, the reason that book has power, Master said, is because it has my vibrations. That's what he told Swami Kriyananda. Swami thought, this is 1948 when Swami's 22 years old. Swami, Master asked Swami, what did you think of my autobiography of a yogi? And Swami said, I loved it. It completely changed my life. That's why he was there in front of Master asking to be his disciple. He said, I found it was a living power. Master said, that's because it has my vibrations. Swami confesses that at that moment, all he could think of was standing on something that was shaking like this, you know, like a vibrator, because that was a kind of new word at that time. But what Master did is Master had the God consciousness, and he put some words together to communicate that to us. Intuition first, then comes understanding. Now, when we come to the issue of spiritual life, this is what the Masters are trying to communicate with us. Your intelligence can help you. Your intelligence is a useful tool, but only if it serves intuition instead of serving to take it apart. And the problem with intelligence is that it can have such a deleterious effect on faith if we let it run beyond what it ought to run. Now, I can say all this to all of you because it's self-evident from the path that we're on. This is not a path where we say, there's no answer to that question, you should just believe. Don't ask that question, this is just the way it is. You know, when you challenge the story of Adam and Eve, Master tells this story where he was talking to a very literal biblical religionist, and they were talking about certain things in the Bible, and the man was asserting every word in the Bible is true. And so Master said, well, what about the story of Adam and Eve where the serpent speaks? Because, of course, it's allegorical, it's not literal. And the man just said, in those days, serpents could talk. And Master said, I bow to the colossal temple of ignorance I see before me. I mean, what can you say with things like that? I mean, that's a kind of belief, but that's blind belief. That's not what we're counseling. We're counseling belief based on actual experience, supported then by that which is beautiful and harmonious. And that's the truth that we need. Now let me think where I was going with that. That's why the Masters constantly emphasize this concept of attunement. That's why Jesus talks in the Bible here, and he's talking about, I am the vine, my Father is the husbandman. Everything in you that does not bear fruit will be purged, will be taken away, so that that which is left will be able to bear greater fruit. And what's taken away from us is this part of ourselves that wants to cling to our own sense-induced, mind-born insistence on this is the way things must be, instead of that still small voice within us that says, yes, but if it isn't harmonious and beautiful, it can't be true. You know, the soul has this insatiable longing for such a deep level of satisfaction, and we're always getting sucked into lesser levels. I received over the internet, as one does, one of those little video, and you know, sometimes I just at least check them to see if they're worth doing. And this was a song. Let's see, and the song was "I Choose Love," and it was, you know, in the little picture there. You had so all these, you know, pretty nice photographs, and then you had some guy singing in the background, and it wasn't awful. It was well meant. You could feel that the man really meant it. And he talked about, you know, you can look at, it was true, you can look at ugliness or you can look at happiness, and wherever I see, I choose love. You could sort of see him, you know, kind of going like this the whole way. And it was, it got you. It was a happy melody, and you could feel kind of the longing of the heart kind of getting stirred up. Yeah, yeah, that's right, I choose love. And then the chorus, you know, join me and everybody, let's all choose love. And you sort of hear it like that and you think, why not? Sure, let's do it. I felt it within me in this way. It opened within me an almost unbearable longing for that to be true. And the reason I knew it was unbearable is because the level of consciousness from which that song was written and the level of consciousness it awakened within me, on that level it could never be fulfilled. Do you understand? Because it just wasn't about... it wasn't about the power and the commitment and the absolute self-sacrifice that's required to lift ourselves above this sort of mind-grabbing for all this happiness. And the only thing wrong with all this mind-grabbing for happiness, there's only one problem with it. it doesn't work. You know, it's not like it's sinful or horrible, you're going to go to hell if you have all these other desires and keep thinking that if I can just get it worked out and get my little human life from birth to death in order, that I'll be happy. The only problem with that is it doesn't work. It's simply not spiritual law. Spiritual law is Sanatana Dharma, which is we were created for another purpose, and even though the human mind can only perceive this one incarnation, intuition knows there must be more. I remember just before my mother, in the last years of my mother's life, we rarely had serious metaphysical discussions. I would say never about anything. This is probably the one I'm going to give you. And I asked her something about, you know, are you anxious about dying? And she said, I just hate to think of all this going on and my not being here anymore. And it was such a cute answer. I just thought, well, that's a point of view, certainly. You know, just like this is where it's happening and what will happen if I'm not here anymore. And that was how she perceived things. What could I say? She wasn't asking, there was nothing more I could answer. The only way that you'll ever learn that is the way all of us learn it, by doing it over and over and over and over again, and over and over and over again, and over and over and over and over and over again, beyond you can't even imagine. In Autobiography of Yogi, Master puts it so sweetly. You know, he says, even tragedy is interesting. He said, what happens over all these incarnations is it assumes a certain anguishing monotony, which is, oh dear, here we are again. I recall this little baby I was watching once. He was a baby of very high consciousness. And he was having his diapers changed. And he was lying on his back, and his mother was changing his diapers. And I happened to look in, and he had his head turned like this. You know, it's like he was just trying to get as far away from the whole process, and he was sort of looking up like that. And maybe I projected, but I felt like what he was thinking was, oh my God, are we here again? You know, like I can't even control myself in the most elemental ways. You know, just like, how did I get here? That's the anguishing monotony of it. And after a time, what happens, you see, is we try it over and over, and we begin to think there's got to be another answer. And the reason we think there has got to be another answer is because deep within ourselves, we are that bliss state. We are one with God. However much we have costumed ourselves, like that atheist man had costumed himself so magnificently to be an atheist. I mean, even though I couldn't stand his vibration, a part of me just wanted to cheer him. Well, if you're going to be an atheist, you're being a real good one. You know, you're just playing that role out to the end as if, you know, and his whole demeanor also just radiated sensuality. You know, just like hedonism and grasping this world. And he was, with all due respect, really ugly. You know, just like ugly. He didn't have anything in him that made your heart sing, oh, I want to be like that. You know, you look at the eyes of Paramahansa Yogananda, even paintings of Christ, and you think, oh, Lord, if I could only be like that. You go to Florence and see the paintings that Fra Angelico did. He was a very holy monk, and he did all these paintings in the cells of all the monks there, and now the whole monastery is an art museum. And you just walk from one to the other, and he painted all these scenes of Christ, and they're just paintings. They're not photographs of any real person like Yogananda's eyes are really his eyes. But you just see something in there, and everything in you says, oh, I want to be like that. Because it's not an anguishing, oh, if only it could be true. It's the realization coming back into yourself. Oh, it is true. You see, and that's where all our power comes from. And the great art of living in this world is to have trust and courage in that perception and the willingness to really put our eggs in that basket and not play it halfway. You know, I'll put some of my eggs in this basket, but I'll also protect myself in this way. And I'll sort of be committed to one path, but I'll also keep my mind open to lots of other paths. And, you know, I'll help a little bit with this, but not completely, because I'm an independent kind of person. I mean, there's all the different ways we play it. But to really have the courage to perceive what's true and not hold back from it. You've heard me say it before, but it's such a beautiful part of the end of the life of Christ when he started challenging his disciples, eat my body and drink my blood, he said. I mean, just imagine if I was here and I said, I have a new teaching to introduce to you. From now on, you must eat my body and drink my blood. You know, how would you feel? And what if I didn't explain it? Which he didn't explain it. I mean, he didn't do it in a mocking way. He said it with the consciousness of what he meant. His body, it was the vibration of Om. His blood is the Christ consciousness, the bread and the wine. He didn't introduce a ritual. He introduced a truth. He used those words, well, what is my body? And when he would say, my body, for those who had the intuition to feel, they knew he wasn't talking about his physical body. They knew he wasn't talking about his physical blood. But you had to have the intuition to hear that. Or if you couldn't understand it, you had to know, there's something deep here, but I don't know what it is. Now, it takes real intelligence to silence your intelligence in the face of intuition, which is, I've experienced this man. Imagine being a disciple of Christ. You've experienced, you've been in his presence. You've had these transcendent realities revealed to you. You've felt the overwhelming joy of his vibration. You've watched yourself change. All of you have experienced that. So many of you have told me, you know, I don't know, but I'm just different than I was. Something happened and I would so have gotten upset and I just didn't get upset. I used to have this terrible addiction to this particular thing or that particular thing, and I don't know, I'm just not interested anymore. My life used to be like this, and now it's different. Those are the real experiences of spiritual life. It's not bells and whistles and all these exciting sort of hopping around the room sort of things. It's day after day, year after year, the ever-growing presence of joy, the presence of courage in your life. Well, there you are. You're a disciple of Christ. You're following him because you have had this experience. And then he starts throwing these things out at you that you can't solve with your nice mind. And if you've been playing it both ways, I'm going to follow him with my intuition, but it's also, you know, it's like we're a pretty special group, aren't we? You know, we're all just following this great man and the others. They're not as smart as us. You know, whatever you're doing. Or else he's managed to satisfy all your little reasoning. You like him because he agrees with you. I like his teachings because it's just exactly what I've always thought. How many times have you heard people say that? And then you think, well, gosh, I hope he's thinking more than you're thinking. But you, all the different ways, we play it both ways. So what happened was many exited. The line in the Bible, the disciples said one to another, this is a very hard teaching. I mean, and it was real life. It was like if I had said that to you and you all were sort of having bagels and one whispers to another, what the heck is she talking about? The disciples said one to another, this is a very hard teaching. And from that point, many walked with him no more. Because when he contradicted their comfortable mental understanding of things, many of them did not have the strength within themselves. It didn't have anything to do with whether he was the Christ or not. It was how much strength did they have within themselves to go with their superconscious and to allow the husbandman to cut away their comfortable habit of just holding on to making sure that it's reasonable and it all agrees with everyone else. That's not the true vine. The true vine is the superconscious. The other is just the servant of it. And when the servant tries to be the master, then nothing in the household is either harmonious or beautiful. And then in this moment in the Bible is when Jesus says to Peter, will you also leave me? It's presented in the Bible, such a neutral question. Jesus is just looking at Peter. I mean, you know, everybody makes these people into such cardboard characters. Peter is just a cartoon of absolute obedience. You know, we lose everything about the fact that he was one of us. So Jesus just looks at him. The master looks at his disciple and says, what are you going to do? Are you going to leave me? And then Peter gives the perfect disciple's answer. He says, Lord, where could I go? And what he's saying there is, my mind is no more satisfied than all the other rats who are deserting, he said. But I intuitively know that I belong to you, that you belong to me, that you were sent to me by God, and my salvation is with you. What other reality is there? And then that's the point at which Jesus says to him, you are a rock of divine understanding. He didn't say, I'm going to build a Catholic church. That's a completely ridiculous thing. But upon this rock of divine understanding, I can build a temple of self-realization within you. Now, few of us, none of us in this life are walking with Jesus. We're not even walking with Master. We are walking with Swami. But there's many times when God looks at us and says, will you also leave me? And it's a tremendously powerful position on the spiritual path when you have no idea intellectually what you're doing or why, but you absolutely know with a power so much bigger than your mind, where could I go? This is the only reality. That's when you become a real devotee. It doesn't matter whether I'm happy or sad or know what I'm doing or not. We say this every week in the Festival of Light. The bird flies, and after a few hours, darkness descends, which is to say the bird no longer can run the show himself. The darkness descends, and he cries, how can I fly in this darkness? And they say, peace awaits you in the unknown. Surrender to me. Offer yourself to me. But that me you're offering yourself is not external. It's your own inner intuitive understanding that the answer is harmonious and beautiful, and I have seen it, and nothing will take me away from that goal.